President, the convention is about to begin. Is there any doubt in your mind that you'll be the nominee?
No.
There's no doubt in my mind that I will be the nominee.
If I may, I'd like to follow up on that, because we may find ourselves in some disagreement. I brought along the latest CBS tally of delegates. We try to stay in touch with the delegates, have over the period of this campaign. And I'm told that just today, our compilation is at 429 Carter delegates told CBS News they disapprove of the way you're handling the economy. 241 Carter delegates said they disapprove of how you're handling foreign policy. And 113 Carter delegates disapprove of how you're handling your job in general.
When you quote those figures, they sound very impressive, but you have to remember that you're talking about a total of more than 3,000 delegates, a substantial majority of whom, about 60%, support me. And although someone might disapprove of something that I do with foreign policy or the economy or the rate of inflation and so forth, the fact that they prefer me above other candidates in the Democratic Party and certainly against any Republican is a significant thing. We don't claim to be perfect. We've made some mistakes in the minds of many people, but I think that my prediction that I'll be the nominee will be carried out next Thursday.
Because Mr. Carter is so confident that he is the choice of the majority of the delegates, last week there were Kennedy people clinging to the hope that he might somehow release all the delegates to vote as they please. No way will that happen, say his campaign manager and his chief of staff. But the issue is so crucial to the nomination, we decided to put it right to the president. Is there a possibility, despite the denials, that he would release his delegates?
No.
Any chance of that happening at all?
None at all.
None whatever?
No. We have had some of my very strong supporters point out to me, Dan, that if I should release the delegates after the rule for loyalty and against the brokered convention is confirmed, that it would be a demonstration of strength. There is no doubt in my mind that if I release those delegates, they would still vote for me, 98% of them. They have signed a pledge to vote for me, and they would not violate their word of honor.
Mr. President, with all respect, let me make the opposite argument, which I know you've heard. But there are any number of people who make these following points, and included among these people are many who like you, support you, and still think you can win. Make the argument, things change. The primaries covered many months. Many events have happened since then. People have changed their minds since then. Your own job rating in the polls is at an all-time low for any president since the polls started. Leaders of your own party are concerned. So why not, whatever the moral principle may be as you see it, why not have an up or down vote of confidence at this convention?
We went through a long series of reforms to say that once the voters go to the polls and choose a nominee, later the delegate is chosen to represent that expression of support for a certain candidate, myself or Senator Kennedy or whoever, and then that delegate is supposed to go and accurately represent the voters. They are not my delegates. They are the people's delegates who are sending them.
Mr. President, surely you're aware that not only the leadership of the Democratic Party, but those Democrats who are running for offices from county judge up through state legislature, U.S. representative, are as of this moment, many of them absolutely petrified that with you at the head of the ticket, that it's going to be a wipeout for the Democratic Party in November.
Dan, that's a gross exaggeration.
Is it?
Sure, it's an exaggeration. You know, Democrats don't get petrified when poll results go up and down.
I agree with you. They do go up and down. They come
sure
and they go. I think, number one, you would agree that over the past year and a half period, that while there have been ups and downs, that the trend for you has been down. Would you agree with that?
No.
You would not?
Well, Dan, right now they're down. The polls are down. This time 4 years ago, we had an enormous lead over President Ford, and as you know, the final results in November were very close. Last October, September, November, when Senator Kennedy was deciding whether or not to run for president, the polls showed that if he should run, that I would be defeated by a margin of 3 or 4 to 1. And many people who advised him very closely predicted to him that if he ever should announce as a candidate, that I would probably withdraw and not even go into the contest since my prospects were so hopeless. So at that time, I was at an abysmal low. the polls that count in a democratic society like ours are the polls that are conducted among the people on election day. There is no doubt in my mind that in November I will be elected president, because in my entire lifetime there has never been a sharper difference between two parties and two men than there will be in 1980. The only possible time that would even approach the significance of this election was when Barry Goldwater ran against Lyndon Johnson. That was a sharp difference. The same degree of difference, even a greater difference, exists in 1980.
Mr. President, I know that you will agree that one of the major differences between this year's election and 1964 is that you have a record that you have to run on.
That's right.
President Johnson was an incumbent of sorts in 64, but he did not have a long record at that time. Now, in your record, you promised that you'd have inflation down to 4% by the end of your first term. Fact is, inflation's running, my last look, was 14.8 annual inflation rate. You promised you'd have balanced budgets by the end of your first term. You haven't had a balanced budget in a year. There's no balanced budget in sight. You promised that you would reform the tax system. You said that our tax system was, and I quote directly, that it's a disgrace to the human race, unquote. Tax system remains pretty much the same. You promised that you would reduce the number of federal agencies from 1,900 down to 200. There's still 1,500 federal agencies. Now, it strikes me that any reasonable person looking at record would say that's a record of ineffective leadership.
I think you'll find in the election months ahead that your prediction will not come true.
I've been wrong before, as you know.
Some of those things we attempted and could not accomplish. We've had a substantial increase in government services. We've had a substantial reduction in the number of federal employees who deliver services to the American people. We've had a sharp reduction in the deficit that's been achieved between my own administration and that of President Ford's. We've had consistent economic goals that we have achieved.
When we pointed out a string of economic failures, the president referred us to his successes in increasing jobs, cutting back on regulatory agencies, and paving the way for a revitalization of industry. He said he thought he had done a good job in holding down inflation and interest rates, considering the way oil prices had skyrocketed since he took office. He then gave us a few sketchy details of his new economic plan, the one he mentioned briefly in his address last week to the convention of the National Urban League. It would, he said, take advantage of taxes on so-called windfall profits.
This is a $227 billion fund that's taken from the excess profits of the oil companies that will be invested in the conservation of energy, revitalization of our transportation system, and the production of synthetic fuels and the production of energy from the solar power and from coal. It will create literally hundreds of thousands of jobs the first year and millions of jobs over the next decade.
Is it a coincidence, just a coincidence, that's being proposed just before the convention?
No. This possibility for us to put into effect the benefits of the windfall profits tax, which, by the way, Governor Reagan wants to repeal and so-called unleash, to quote him, the oil companies, has been the result of 3 years of hard work. And only this year, early this year, has it finally got to be a part of the American law and the American tax system.
Let's get back to the convention in politics. Any chance that you would consider replacing Mr. Mondale is your vice presidential running mate?
No, none at all. I think Fritz Mondale is not only the best partner that a president ever had in this office, but also the best vice president.
Under the provision of the Democratic Charter to be adopted this week, under the Charter, there's a provision that discrimination or prejudice based on sexual orientation is prohibited in all party affairs. Realistically, do you think all Democratic candidates in all portions of the country can run on that?
No, the Democratic Party and the candidates and the voters are so completely fragmented and disparate and are such strong individuals that each one would have a different approach to almost any part of the Democratic platform. And that's obviously one of those controversial issues, as is abortion, gun control, Equal Rights Amendment, and so forth. So I don't think you would have unanimity among Democrats on any issue.
Mr. President, I do not wish to spend much time on the Billy Carter affair. I'm sorry, I know that you would like to spend a great deal of time on that at this particular time. But in listening to you on Monday evening, it appeared to me that you were attempting to frame the issue incorrectly, perhaps not purposely so, but incorrectly, that you argued that Billy never influenced American policy on Libya.
Yes.
It seems to me that that's not really in dispute, but the issue is that you may have showed a lack of judgment in permitting Billy to lead the Libyans on when you should have and could have stopped him right away.
There are several issues. I think the most important issue was whether or not anyone in the White House or in my administration had done anything illegal or improper. And the answer is that no one did. And the other question was whether Billy had any influence on me or whether he had any influence on anyone in the government. And the answer is he did not. And the third question is, did he try to influence me relating to Libya or anyone in the government? And the answer is that he did not.
What did you do to let the Libyans know that Billy wouldn't have any influence on you whatsoever?
The Libyans, I think, were able to observe whether or not our policy changed with respect to the delivery of airplanes and so forth, and of course they saw that our policies did not change.
In retrospect, might it have been a mistake not to have sent a message clearly, publicly, to the Libyans, that if you have any idea that Billy has any influence with me, I want to make certain you understand that he does not? Looking back on it, would that not have been something that you should and could have done?
Dan, since your question is hypothetical in nature, let me give you a hypothetical answer. If I had known in March that Billy had received any sort of loan or payment or money in any fashion from the Libyans, then I should have done what you just described. Had I known that he had any sort of financial relationship with Libya, I would have made it clear to Billy and to Libya that this was a non-productive effort that might have been mounted by Libya.
Mr. President, have you suggested to Billy that he return that money forthwith to the Libyans?
I have not talked to Billy about Libya under any circumstances since the first day of July.
Do you think it would be a good idea if he returned the money to Libya?
I think it would be, yes. The last thing I said in my press conference statement was that I was deeply concerned about Billy's receiving any money or favors from Libya and his possible obligation to Libya, but that under no circumstances in the past or the future would he have any influence on me in our relationship with Libya, and under no circumstances in the past or future would I derive any direct or indirect benefit from Billy's relationship with Libya, either while I'm in this office or after I leave this office.
But you would like to see him return that money as soon as possible?
Yes, that would be my preference.
Have you talked to your mother about this problem, Mr. President?
Yes.
What did she say, sir?
I think I won't relay your private conversation with my mother.
I'll respect that, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. President, there's been some obfuscation. I'm not, again, certain whether it was purposefully done or not, about will you or won't you debate on the same platform Governor Reagan and Representative Anderson. Will you give me a yes or no answer about that?
The answer is yes, but I would like to pursue that answer just one step further. The most important thing is for me and Reagan, just the two of us, to have a complete ability and opportunity to debate every issue, domestic and foreign, that's important to the American people. I hope we'll have several debates. That's one part, and that's the most important part. The other part that I have said is that I would participate in a debate along with Governor Reagan and any other candidate who was qualified in enough states where he had a theoretical chance to be elected president if he carried all those states. And that would certainly include John Anderson, the former congressman.
So you are prepared to debate on the same platform during the campaign, both Governor Reagan and Representative Anderson?
That's correct.
I believe you said, correct me if I'm wrong, if you haven't said, may I assume that you think Representative Anderson, if he stays in the race, would take more votes from you than he would from Governor Reagan?
Well, let me put it this way, Dan. I'll be running against two Republicans. One Democrat, two Republicans. I think it would be too early for me to get into the role of characterizing how Reagan differs from Anderson and so forth. But I'm willing to do it. I don't have any choice in the matter. My preference would be to run against one person.
Do you have any indication, do you have any suspicion that Governor Reagan and or some of his supporters are putting money into Anderson's campaign in hopes of hurting you?
No, I don't.
If I may carry this forward, just one additional step. I thought perhaps it might be informative and we might have a good time with it for that matter. Could you give me, if you will, what you consider to be the single biggest asset and the single biggest weakness of Representative Anderson?
Well, the single biggest asset, I guess, would be an absolute capability to take different positions on different issues to accommodate the circumstances.
And his biggest weakness?
He's not bound by any sort of party commitment or platform or convention support. He's just a freewheeling agent that can change his position as he sees fit. The biggest weakness would be that he doesn't have the structure of a party organization behind him, and he's never won a primary. He entered a numerous numbers of primaries and caucuses. He never won one, and he's characterized, I think, at least by many people, as someone who lost and who abandoned his own party ostensibly to continue a personal campaign. I say that not in derogation of him. I'm trying to answer the question. That's the freedom is an asset, and the lack of a structured campaign and having a series of victories behind you, I would say, would be a detrimental factor. But I've never thought this through ahead of time. I didn't anticipate the question.
I'm glad to hear that. I hope that we'd be able to ask at least one. Senator Kennedy, his greatest weakness, greatest asset?
I think his greatest asset is the heritage that he bears with the Kennedy name. And in many of the finest elements of his two brothers, he has carried forward those fine elements. I don't want to try to assess his the negative factors that he has to bear. I think the main thing is that he didn't wind up with enough delegates to get the nomination.
Biggest strength, biggest weakness, Governor Reagan.
Well, I think Governor Reagan's biggest strength is the fact that he's been so successful in capturing the Republican nomination after formidable opposition from some very attractive opponents. The biggest weakness is his stand on the issues.
In brief, Mr. President, because I'm sure you could speak the rest of the afternoon on this next one. Principal strength, principal weakness, Jimmy Carter.
I think our record in dealing with difficult issues without flinching, war, peace, for ourselves in the Middle East, in adherence to human rights, dealing with energy and economic matters, never evading a difficult question will be appreciated by the American people. So I would say that is a great strength, along with 3.5 years of experience, which the American people can assuage and adjust, rather, can judge. And the biggest problem is the fact that we still face uncertain and difficult times.
What would be wrong with setting a deadline, a date, for the Iranians to release our hostages, say, by October 1st, our hostages have to be out, or I, the President of the United States, will consider this an act of war by the Iranians.
If we were dealing with a rational government, what you propose would be feasible. We're dealing with a group of fanatics who have violated every principle of human decency and human rights in holding 52 absolutely innocent Americans hostage, away from their families, away from freedom, away from communication with the outside world, away from medical attention, for the last months. So we're not dealing with rational people. Secondly, there is no government there with whom we can deal. The elected president has no power at all. He's given authority under the Constitution to choose a prime minister. He can't even choose his own prime minister. He and the Secretary of State or the foreign minister both want to have their hostages released. They have lost power because of it. So we're not dealing with rational people. And a threat or a deadline, I'm afraid, and I believe, might very well result in the death or the injury to our hostages.
Do you believe that it would be more likely that the hostages would be freed if Governor Reagan was elected? After all, there'd be a good reason then that the Iranians might want to make a gesture to a new administration. You would have been removed as the man, as they see it, responsible for protecting the Shah. It might be a way to get it off dead center, it strikes me. Does it strike you that way?
No. We've had intelligence reports from quite early this year that the Ayatollah Khomeini may be considering holding the hostages until after our election in order to try to influence Americans in how they voted. I don't know if that's an accurate report or not, but it may be that after a certain event occurs, after Ramadan this next few weeks, after the Speaker and the Prime Minister are chosen with a new modulus, some change in tone of world events, maybe our election, that will be triggered in the Iranians' minds, a commitment to release the hostages. I can't predict when it will be, but I don't think the election of a certain person in our country as president will be the determining factor at all.
Mr. President, on the day that you announced the plan to boycott the Olympics, you said the Soviet military presence in Afghanistan, and I quote, is the most serious threat to world peace since the Second World War.
Yes.
Do you really mean that?
Certainly since the Soviet invasion and domination of the Eastern European countries that now comprise the Warsaw Bloc, yes. Afghanistan was formerly a buffer nation between the Soviet Union and Pakistan and Iran. That buffer has now been changed into a wedge between Pakistan and Iran. If the Soviets thrust southward and try to take, say, Iran with its oil resources and have a dominant presence around the Persian Gulf, it would have an enormous strategic importance and a threat not only to ourselves, but to every nation on earth dependent upon oil from that troubled region. It's crucial that we stand firm against the Soviet Union, and it's equally crucial, maybe even more so, that we get as many nations as possible to join in with us. We joined 103 other nations in the United Nations to condemn the Soviet invasion and to call for their withdrawal.
Mr. President, that's ineffective. Sorry to interrupt.
I'm sorry.
I mean, that was totally ineffective, was it not?
I don't think it's ineffective at all. The Soviets have now stood condemned in an unprecedented way, not only by ourselves in the Western world, but also by the Muslim countries, some of whom were formerly intimate friends of the Soviet Union, and the non-aligned movement. We restrained the shipment of feed grains to the Soviet Union and got 50 other nations to join with us in boycotting the Olympics. We also decided to register our young men for the draft. I might say this is a sum total of a very effective political and economic move. I might add, coincidentally, but importantly, Governor Reagan opposed registration for the draft. Governor Reagan opposed the restraint on the sale of American feed grains to the Soviet Union. Governor Reagan opposed the boycott of the Moscow Olympics. And when he was asked, what would you do to meet the threat of the Soviet Union in Southwest Asia in the invasion of Afghanistan, he replied, I would put a naval blockade around Cuba in the Caribbean Ocean.
You told the world through your national security advisor that the Soviet brigade in Cuba was unacceptable. Then you accepted it. Now, what kind of signal does that send out to friend and foe alike?
Dan, that brigade has been in Cuba since 1962. It has no capability of attacking the United States. When the Soviets were in Berlin and built the Berlin Wall, President Kennedy said that Berlin Wall is unacceptable. The Berlin Wall is not acceptable to the American people. And to the same degree, the presence of a Soviet brigade in Cuba is unacceptable to us. It doesn't mean that we're going to invade Cuba to root it out, or invade East Berlin to tear down that wall, or invade Afghanistan to root out the Soviet troops. It means that the world will never accept the reason for the presence of those troops in Cuba, or the troops in Afghanistan, or the Berlin Wall.
Mr. President, do you recognize how pervasive the feeling is in the country that you have not managed well Afghanistan, what's happened in Afghanistan, the Iranian situation, the Cuban situation, and foreign policy in general? Now, you travel around a good deal. You must have heard it yourself. I hear it at truck stops, coffee shops, cafeterias. What I hear, Mr. President, is Jimmy Carter is a good and decent man. And a lot of people say, I like him. But a lot of people will say right behind that, I think the job's too big for him. Seems to me that the essential point here is one of leadership and management of the country's foreign policy and domestic policy. Do you hear that? Do your people tell you that?
Every time I watch evening news, I hear it. And I see the results in the polls. And obviously, hear it from reporters and from private citizens. I am proud of what we have done and what our nation is. In nuclear strategic capability, we are making great progress. In the strengthening of NATO and our other alliances around the world, we have made great progress. In keeping our nation at peace, mine is one of the few administrations in history where our nation has been at peace for 3.5 years, and I pray it'll be at peace until I leave this office. We have spread the benefits of peace to other countries like Israel and Egypt. We have stood firm for our basic principles for human rights, and we've seen democracy come to nations like Zimbabwe and Nigeria and to several countries in this hemisphere.
What do you consider to be your major mistake this year, Mr. President?
In retrospect, you can pick out some things that might have been done if you had known ahead of time that events that are unpredictable would have occurred. Had we known ahead of time that the Iranians would have seized our hostages, we could have taken some different step. It's hard to know what could have been done. Had we known ahead of time that the Soviets would have invaded Afghanistan, we may have taken some additional measures, but not being able to know those things ahead of time, you can't say what could have been done. The president has a unique responsibility. You can't share it with others. Quite often your advisors are divided 50-50 on a very important issue. Sometimes your advisors are wrong. The president has the ultimate responsibility. And in order to deal with those potential crises in such a way that they don't become actual crises, there is a lonely, important decision-making process that goes on within the mind of one person, the president. And if he makes a mistake in judgment that's of serious dimensions, it could affect the future of the entire world.
Mr. President, you recently directed your staff to make report cards on their employees. Now, in specific areas, I'm going to ask you to grade yourself, A through F, foreign policy.
Dan, this is a little bit embarrassing because I'm a highly prejudiced
I recognize
analyst.
That, but you also prided yourself on your candor and straight talk.
You put me on the spot. I would say maybe a B or C plus on foreign policy, but I'd like to equivocate some, if you'll permit me, as a politician, by saying that the maintenance of our nation at peace and strong is such a dominant factor that it may be that a more disinterested observer would give me a little bit higher grade.
You give yourself a C plus, but you think a B minus might be justified.
I think B minus. Let's say B minus.
Overall domestic policy.
under the circumstances, I think about a B. The actual results, maybe C.
On energy specifically?
Very good. I think we've done better on energy than we had anticipated, and that's one of the great achievements of our administration, is putting into place, under the most difficult possible circumstances, an energy policy that will pay rich dividends in the future. I'd say an A in that.
A in that?
I think so.
On the economy, you can't give yourself an A on the economy.
Well, that's what I was really referring to about actual results, because the inflation rate and unemployment are too high. And that was the C that I gave myself before.
And on leadership?
Well, in international affairs, our country is still a leader. On human rights, there's no doubt that we are a leader. In military strength, we are a leader. There is a growing realization in this country and in my own mind, however, that we are no longer dominant, in that we cannot enforce our will on others. That's an inevitable consequence of changing times. So I would say that leadership, reasonably good, maybe a B. I don't want to be held on kind of those scores. I'll see what the American people say in November.
Office, we went downstairs to the library where Rosalind Carter joined us. Mostly we asked her about him. We started, however, by asking him about her.
She's helped me by being on the phone with crucial delegates in the last few days. She's a good seamstress. She makes a lot of her own clothes. She also takes care of me and Amy and our needs on the sewing machine. But she's also a close friend and partner and confidant. And sweetheart. So we kind of share almost everything. She likes to run, likes to swim, likes to fish, also likes to be involved in the political campaign.
Let's talk about this role as confidant. That extends, as we know, and as you've talked about a number of times, to politics, problem of getting renominated, reelected, and to policy as well, does it not?
Well, I think Jimmy and I just talk about the things that we're really interested in to each other. I think that husbands and wives just do that. He makes the decisions. I tell him what I think about them sometimes. But he makes the decisions, and we not only Jimmy and I talk about things, but just with the family. We have always done this at the table, whatever is happening that's interesting. The whole family talks about him, so I think that it's just a good family relationship.
Well, you mentioned you sometimes disagree. What's the last major policy decision about which you disagree?
Well, I never have talked about specifics because then I lose my effectiveness. Well, but I have talked to him. I nag sometimes. I worry him. I've had him say, just don't mention that to me anymore. I am not going to change my mind. And I think maybe sometimes timing, don't you think? I got really upset about the announcement about the budget cuts just before the New York primary. And he said, we have to stop inflation. The reason I got upset was because nobody knew. At that point, the people didn't know what the cuts were. And if they had known, it would not have been as bad. But you couldn't spell them out right then. But he kept saying, the psychology of the inflation is such right now that I have to make this statement. It's for the good of the country. Don't you want me to do what's best for the people of the country? And I said, yes, but can't you wait a little while? He said, no, it's best. We have to do it right now. So those are the kinds of things that sometimes we get in some real arguments about.
Do you think that's the reason he lost the New York primary?
No, well, I think it might have had something to do with it, but I don't think that's totally the reason.
My colleague Mike Wallace recently interviewed Mrs. Reagan, Nancy Reagan, and she said in what was clearly intended to be a kind way, in an understanding way, that she thought that you were a more activist First Lady than she would be.
The opportunities here, a First Lady can do with this position what she wants to do. I have never been comfortable pouring tea all day, every day. I can't do that. That's an important part of this position, but I have to be doing the things that are important to me and the things that I'm interested in. The poor, the elderly. If I sat here and did not do what I thought I could do to help them, I just think that would be terrible. So I intend, as long as I'm here, to do those things that I can to help people in our country who need help.
You don't consider yourself too much, quote, up front?
No.
if you could speak from the heart, which is difficult to do in, mm-hmm. in a campaign, and I understand that, what would you say to Nancy Reagan about the rigors of a presidential campaign as opposed to any other kind of campaign? The kind of pressure she's going to be under as a person?
I think it's different from anything that I have ever been involved in, and I've been involved in a lot of political campaigns. But it's different. It's so open, and there's so much pressure, and there is no way to hide any kind of anything. There's no way to hide anything. You have to be completely open and honest. Every part of your life is bad to every person in the United States.
And that's difficult, and
you,
isn't it?
And you accept that. And if you don't accept it, I think you have a terrible time. I think you have to accept that your life is an open book, that everything that you have ever done is going to be exposed. And I always said that we were fortunate to grow up in Plains because everybody always knew everything you did anyway, and you couldn't hide anything if you wanted to. But that's one thing you have to come up. And also, I think that you have to have enough confidence to know that in my case, my husband is the best possible candidate for that position, and the positions he takes on the issues are the positions that would be best for the country. And you have to know that and fight for it, because you're going to get everything you do is going to be criticized, and every position you take is going to be taken apart. So you have to first be willing to expose yourself, and second, have your self-confidence and your confidence in your husband.
This is a change of subject, but it occurs to me to ask, is it more difficult for you to do this kind of interview with your husband in the room?
No. It's more difficult for me to make a speech when he's in the room. I hadn't thought about an interview with him being difficult. I don't like interviews with him when he does all the talking and I sit and look at him. I don't like to do that. But when you ask me questions, too, I enjoy it.
We talked earlier about the Billy Carter affair, and I don't intend to dwell on it. But again, it occurs to me to ask, and I know you know Billy Carter's wife, Sybil, well. Have you talked to her about this?
Only once.
Recently?
Well, several weeks ago, I called her and I said, I just want you to know we love you. And she answered back with yes and no, because she thinks, I don't know why, but I think she thinks her telephone is tapped. And that was the extent, and that's the only time I've been in touch with her. At home, I saw her in Plains during the vacation, but we didn't mention anything at all about it.
You haven't said to her, I'm sorry we got into all this.
I said, I want you and Billy to know that we love you and we are sorry all of this happened.
Amazing.
And she said, I'm sorry too. And that was just about other than yes or no. I think those are only a few words she said. And when I told Jimmy, we decided it was because she thought her telephone was tapped.
Let's talk politics for a moment. Your husband has complimented you and said that you're very good as a campaigner, you're very good with politics, and he obviously listens to you. Whether he always does what you recommend or not is something else, isn't it? Where is Jimmy Carter's base in this election? Seems to me that what has been the Democratic Party's base for half a century is gone.
Well, I disagree with you on your premise that the Democratic constituency is gone. Democrats argue and fight. They push for all they can get, for all kinds of demands. But when things are uncomfortable or when there are difficulties in the country, people blame whoever's in charge.
You don't think it's flat?
I don't. People in this country want somebody that can deal with a crisis, whether it's an energy crisis, an economic crisis, an Iranian crisis. You know, we could have been in war in Iran if we had not had somebody very level-headed here in the White House. Whether it's a personal crisis like Billy Carter, if you want to call that a crisis, you can deal with it in a way that I think makes the American people proud when they look at it. So I'm very proud of him, and I think you're going to look and see that Democratic constituency come together.
Ms. Carter, you travel around a good deal, and I know you read a good bit. I know from my past experience that you read the newspapers carefully. Is there anything that you've seen in print or seen on television lately that you said to yourself, that's wrong, and it makes me angry that they're saying that?
Yes.
What was it?
I don't know what I can just say one thing. I get mad sometimes when I watch news or read something in the paper, particularly when somebody who has, and I'm not talking about press, isn't that nice? But when somebody stands up and derides the fact that we are so energy dependent on foreign oil, when they were here as part of an administration for almost 8 years and left us with this program, with this problem, and now blame it on us, I can't accept that. And then the other thing is that I know that he knew better, and that makes me mad.
I can tell that you really, and your husband smiles broadly at that. I think he likes it when you get a little angry that way.
Well, I get mad when we get blamed for the things that were neglected for 8 years, and we are the ones that are trying to straighten them out.
Do you think the press overplayed the Billy Carter affair?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, sensational headlines without knowing what the real substance was.
But surely you can understand that when a brother of a president takes $220,000 from the kind of government that has been led by Colonel Gaddafi, bankrolling worldwide terrorism, that reporters feel they have a responsibility to follow that string all the way down wherever it may lead.
I agree with you. I think it's necessary. I was shocked when we read in the paper that Billy had taken the money. Jimmy was too.
We played a game, not for very long, in your husband's office a short while ago. A ratings game, and I don't mean a television rating game. I wonder if you'd be willing to play it. On a scale of A to F, how would you rate yourself in your job as the president's number one helper? Is that too strong to describe you as that?
Yes, I would say C- on that.
As a political consultant?
I'd say C+ on political consultant. I feel like I understand people in the country because I'm with them. I've been with them so much, and I listen to their hopes and their dreams and their problems and concerns.
And telling them what your instincts are about people, whom to trust and whom not to trust.
I get an A on that because I always tell them.
Mr. President, Ms. Carter, you've been very patient with us and very generous with your time, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you.